Thank you for selecting this message by Dr. James Hoffman. Dr. Hoffman preaches verse by verse through the entire book of the Bible. From all of us at Living Water of Lapine here in Central Oregon, we hope that it will encourage you and feed you spiritually. And if you would like to leave a message after the sermon, our contact information is found on the sermon page where you found this sermon. Now may God richly bless you as you listen.
Have you ever considered this? The tone of our truth-telling can build a wall or a bridge. In 1850, Abraham Lincoln's stepbrother, John D. Johnston, wrote to him and asked, yet again, for a loan so he could settle some of his debts. On previous occasions, Lincoln simply gave Johnston the money. But this time, Lincoln responded with a tough love letter that included a helpful proposal. Dear Johnston, your request for $80, I do not think it best to comply with now. At the various times when I have helped you a little, you have said to me, we can get along very well now. But in a very short time, I find you in the same difficulty again. Now, this can only happen by some defect in your conduct. What that defect is, I think I know. You are not lazy, and still you are an idler. I doubt whether, since I saw you, you have done a good whole day's work in any one day. This habit of uselessly wasting time is the whole difficulty. It is vastly important to you, and still more so to your children, that you should break the habit. You are now in need of some money, and what I propose is that you shall go to work tooth and nail for somebody who will give you money for it, and to secure you a fair reward for your labor. I now promise you that for every dollar you will, between this and the 1st of May, get for your own labor, I will then give you one other dollar. Now, if you will do this, you will soon be out of debt. And what is better, you will have a habit that will keep you from getting in debt again. But if I shall now clear you out of debt, next year, you will be just as deep in as ever. Affectionately, your brother, A. Lincoln. The tone of our truth-telling can build a wall or a bridge. How we tell the truth makes a difference in how the truth is received. If we understood this, as Abraham Lincoln seemed to, perhaps you and I would see better results in the times when we have had to confront someone. Have you ever had confrontation go badly? Kind of a silly question, isn't it? Perhaps we all have. Last week I told you how much I dislike confrontation. But as a pastor, there are times when it is necessary. And if I always avoid it, I would not be worth my weight in salt as a pastor. But guess what? When I said that last week, I'm sure many of you picked up on the fact that as Christians, there will be times that we all need to confront someone who is in the wrong. And unless you're a pugnacious person, always bristling for a fight, you probably identified with me when I spoke of my own reluctance to confront. You know, don't you, that so much can go wrong. Relationships are often demolished, and your reputation gets ravaged as the person goes around telling others how horrible you are. You know this because, unfortunately, this has happened to you. Timothy had his own reluctance to confront. I spoke of this last week from our passage. And in our passage today, the Apostle Paul moves into some practical advice for Timothy on how to confront others. You see, by now, my hope is that you are seeing your own need for Paul's instruction here. Today, we will find in our passage some practical advice to improve our efforts whenever we need to confront. Now, from there, Paul moved to a particular situation in 1 Timothy chapter 5, and it required Timothy to confront some people in the church. So first, we will learn some practical things about how to confront, and second, how the church should help people who are in need. Wherever there is a need, are we obligated because we are Christians to meet it? What about those who would abuse our goodwill? Yes, the first century church faced many of the problems that we do. And so let's get to our passage now. 1 Timothy chapter 5. We begin chapter 5 this week in our study through the book of 1 Timothy. And the first two verses of 1 Timothy chapter 5 read this way. Do not rebuke an older man, but encourage him as you would a father. Younger men as brothers, older women as mothers, younger women as sisters, in all purity. Now, the instructions are comprehensive, covering all four possible relationships, older men, younger men, older women, and younger women. And the basic idea is to act toward the members of God's family as you would act toward your own family. Giving the corrected one the dignity of family relationships will go a long way in successful correction. It's one thing to rebuke someone, giving them dignity, and it is another to do it harshly. All vindictiveness and bitterness must be avoided. Whenever confrontation is necessary, we need to have an attitude of wanting to help the person for the glory of God. Not with an attitude of superiority, which seeks the glory of ourselves. Can I ask you to recall the confrontation that you were part of that went badly for just a moment? Was there any hint of an attitude of superiority in that confrontation? Or was there a greater concern for God's glory than there was for establishing your own? Paul said to treat an older man like a father, An elderly man is not about to listen to a younger one who comes to him with an air of disrespect. Likewise, Timothy was to treat an older woman as he would his mother, and a young man as he would his brother, and a young woman as his sister. The tone of our truth-telling can build a wall or build a bridge. Now, we need to acknowledge that times are different than when Paul wrote this letter to Timothy. Ancient cultures, as immoral as they were, nonetheless thought of the family as a miniature kingdom over which the patriarch presided as the wise king. And they offered their fathers the same dignity and submission owed to a king. Now, sadly, for our day and time, many fathers do not manage their households with dignity, with respect, or high honor, and the children are not likely to offer it to their dad in return. So the advice, appeal to him as father, might not resonate in today's culture as well as it did in Timothy's. Perhaps we might want to consider, from the point that Paul is making here, of adapting it for our own understanding just slightly here, to say, appeal to him as a highly respected king, president, or prime minister. There's some formality and humility in that, isn't there? Older men who are true Christian believers, have more experience and wisdom and in dealing with life. And that's not to say that they are always right. Sometimes they are not. But they do have wisdom and experience. Whenever they need to be confronted, they are not to be disregarded, set aside, or treated as useless. They are to be treated as fathers with affection, respect, and honor. Of course, we all know that older men sometimes hold strong opinions and become set in their ways. They can become close-minded to new ideas, ministries, and methods. The end result is sometimes very tragic in the church, seen by misbehavior, grumbling, complaining, unfair criticism, opposition, and church division. But listen, what we face will never be worse than what Timothy had to deal with in confronting the church elders in Ephesus who were false teachers. And Paul told him, if an older man ever needs to be corrected, he is to be corrected and disciplined as a father, not as an enemy. Firm is acceptable. Abrasive is forbidden. When confronting a younger man, there is to be a sense of treating him as a peer, one who has a common upbringing. In other words, there must not be any sense of superiority again. Perhaps there might be a little less formality that you would give as respect to a king or president, in other words, an older man who needs confronting. But similarly, there cannot be any attitude of superiority. A Same would be true for an older woman and a younger woman. But there's more said about the younger woman. Another emphasis is given about the younger woman here by Paul for how male leadership in the church should treat a younger woman. Extra caution, you see, must be exercised in approaching a young woman. Paul warns that it must be done in all purity in verse 2. The reason for this is obvious. Any impropriety on Timothy's part would ruin his reputation and his ministry. Christian men, especially pastors and others in leadership positions, should never be alone with a female other than their wife in an enclosed room. This advice might seem legalistic, but lives and ministries have been destroyed merely by a false rumor. Christian leaders need to be above reproach. So what a rich store of relational information Paul gives the church with this full span of age and gender. How beautiful is the church that has people who confront in love when it is necessary, treating one another as fathers, mothers, brothers, and sisters. Such a graced family knows how people ought to conduct themselves in God's household, which is the church of the living God, the pillar and the foundation of truth. Such graced conduct means that the gospel will go forth unhindered. Now, the next 14 verses here in chapter 5 of 1 Timothy concern themselves with a situation that Timothy needed to confront. The instructions Paul just gave about confrontation now need to be applied to older men, to older women, young men and young women. Taking care of women who had lost their husbands involved each of these age groups in the church. The church at Ephesus faced problems in their ministering to widows, and anyone who was perpetuating those problems to this important ministry needed to be confronted. I'm going to read all 14 verses all at once, but I got to warn you, some of it will sound confusing. And it probably will not sound at all how a church should try to help a widow in need. We might think that any widow with need, no matter what her age is, no matter how much she has shown godliness in her life, if there's dire need, she ought to be helped. One would think this would be especially true in Paul's day because they didn't have social security. They didn't have government welfare. They didn't even have property laws like we have today, that if the husband dies, his widow automatically receives the property. The wife and children were utterly helpless. Well, let me read this in its entirety, and then we'll discuss it. I'm giving you that warning ahead of time so that you don't tune out if you keep scratching your head, as we read this. We'll go back into it. So let's now read verses 3 through 16. 1 Timothy 5, verses 3 through 16. Honor widows who are truly widows, But if a widow has children or grandchildren, let them first learn to show godliness to their own household and to make some return to their parents, for this is pleasing in the sight of God. She who is truly a widow, left all alone, has set her hope on God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day. But she who is self-indulgent is dead, even while she lives. Command these things as well, so they may be without reproach. But if anyone does not provide for his relatives, and especially for members of his household, he has denied the faith and is worse than an unbeliever. Let a widow be enrolled if she is not less than 60 years of age, having been the wife of one husband, and having a reputation for good works, if she has brought up children, has shown hospitality, has washed the feet of the saints, has cared for the afflicted, and has devoted herself to every good work, but refused to enroll younger widows. For when their passions draw them away from Christ, they desire to marry, and so incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith. Besides that, they learn to be idlers, going about from house to house, and not only idlers, but also gossips and busybodies, saying what they should not. So I would have younger widows marry, bear children, manage their households, and give the adversary no occasion for slander. For some have already strayed after Satan. If any believing woman has relatives who are widows, let her care for them. Let the church not be burdened, so that it may care for those who are truly widows. Were you confused at all? There's some confusing stuff there. Now, the opening instruction, verse 3, controls the thought of all 14 verses. The church must properly recognize its needy widows, literally real widows. Proper recognition, honor, was to be expressed in practical support. But good stewardship of the church's limited resources and protection of its reputation required the leadership to decide who the real widows in the church were and whether other means of support were available. This first century church in Ephesus, it is clear, had a system in place for taking care of its widows. Now, in verses 4 through 8, it shows us that the system was being abused. Families of widows were not shouldering their responsibility, and this was placing a financial strain on the church. Then certain younger widows, who may have managed to get on the list, were threatening the church's reputation by involvement with false teaching and scandalous behavior. Now, that doesn't seem all that confusing here. I'm not confused by any of this so far. These things seem easy enough to understand. But when Paul gives Timothy the solution to these abuses, it becomes very dicey. Paul indicates that only widows who are 60 years and older should be helped. Huh? Shouldn't any widow in such a desperate situation be helped? Oh, now, okay, Paul offers a reason why widows under the age of 60 should not be placed on the list. Oh, good. Let's take a look at his reason. Verses 11 through 15. Let's get this matter clarified for us. Verses 11 through 15, and it reads this way. But refuse to enroll younger widows, for when their passions draw them away from Christ, they desire to marry and so incur condemnation for having abandoned their former faith. Besides that, they learn to be idlers, going about from house to house, and not only idlers, but also gossips and busybodies, saying what they should not. So I would have younger widows marry, bear children, manage their households, and give the adversary no occasion for slander, for some have already strayed after Satan. Whew, good, that settles it. No, doesn't exactly clear it up for us, does it? Paul seems to have a low opinion, an unfair characterization, even, of younger widows. This week, when I was studying the passage, I studied an awful lot of commentaries to see if I could find an answer to what Paul was saying and why he was saying it. The only thing I found has some controversy among Bible scholars. And only three of the many commentaries I was reading even mentioned this solution I'm going to tell you about. One of those three dismissed it in a way that I thought was very unfair. I'll tell you the answer that I found in just a moment, but I do want to make clear to you that most of the commentaries didn't even mention it. And that one of those three that did mention it just passed it off, dismissing it entirely. So let me set this up with some understanding about the way we go about interpreting the Bible. When it comes to understanding Paul's letters, it's very much like listening to only one side of a telephone conversation. Now, it's not a speakerphone, so we cannot hear what is being said on the other end. What we read in Paul's letters is only Paul's answers to their concerns, their problems, and their questions. And often, it isn't quite as clear as what we would want it to be. Now, because of that, as Paul is answering the church's questions or addressing their problem, we have to read these answers and try to put together what the situation is that Paul is dealing with in that church. Like a good detective, we've got to pick up on the cues that are given to us in the passage, and we've got to also pick up on any historical background, cultural background, anything else that we might know that was going on in the church at the time. Now, that's the case with this. We've got to use the clues that we have. Now, here's what we know from the passage. We know that the Ephesian church had a list of widows that some get enrolled in and others do not get enrolled on that list. Widows on this list need to be honored, and that included financial support. You see, the word that Paul used here was the word honorarium, literally. Honorarium, by the way, is not welfare. Honorarium is not a charity. It is a compensation for some effort. Now, in order to be put on this list that receives an honorarium, the widow had to meet some very stringent requirements. And there seems to be some sort of vow that they must never marry again. Some of these widows in Ephesus had denied their vow, and they had turned away from their commitment, which was an essential part of their faith. Now, in addition to the age requirement and not having any family member who could take care of her, there were also these requirements. We saw them as we read through. Having brought up children, having shown hospitality to strangers, having washed the saints' feet, a mark of humility and godliness, having assisted those in distress, having devoted herself to every good work, meaning she didn't wait for opportunities to do good deeds, she looked for them and participated in them. That is quite a list of qualifications. It is certainly no less strict than the qualifications we read earlier in 1 Timothy for an elder and a deacon. In fact, verse 9 states a qualification that is exactly one of the qualifications for an elder or a deacon. They must be, these deacons and elders, they must be a one-woman type of man. And we see in verse 9, to be on this list, she must be a one-man kind of a woman, having been devoted to her husband when he was alive. Strict qualifications. Now, why would Paul write about this list that involved compensation and had such rigorous conditions like these? They were given an honorarium, and once again, that doesn't mean benevolence. It's not a benevolent fund here. Charitable giving doesn't demand such conditions. No, an honorarium is compensation for their service. Our church has a benevolent fund. That's a charity. And there are never such qualifications and conditions that we see here. So here is what I am suggesting to you. This Ephesian church may have had a benevolent fund of their own, where among the needs, other needs that believers had, younger widows could be assisted by that benevolent fund. But that means of helping them was not what Paul is addressing here, because that was not what was being abused. Those who are on this list and this system was. This non-charity, this list of regularly paid servants to the church, this official society of widows who had to meet the same standards of an elder or a deacon, this had some abuse going on. And through our one-way telephone conversation that Paul is having with Timothy, we are hearing Paul tell Timothy that he needed to do some confronting. You see, I believe that this church had at least three official offices in the church. The office of elder, the office of deacon, and the office of widows, who ministered to those in the church with needs from a unique perspective that came from their own suffering. Perhaps they were a form of deaconesses. It's interesting, when Paul was giving the qualifications back in chapter 3 for an elder, and then he went on to deacons right in the middle as he was giving those descriptions for deacons, he says, and women also. Who does that mean? Could it mean the office of widows? Maybe. Maybe. It doesn't say their wives. That's how it's translated in English. It just says, and the women also. Could be them. I don't know. Now you say, Pastor, okay, come on. Is all this just your guesswork? Sure, you're assembling some clues here, but give us something more than that. What other evidence is there? Well, there is. And this is what only three of the commentators brought out. Multiple writings from church history affirm, about 100 years after Paul wrote this letter, we see an office of widows in the church because they were written about. We know that such an official office existed 100 years after Paul wrote this letter. And of course, over time, it eventually disappeared. We didn't see it today. But the commentator who dismissed it simply said churches probably developed this office because of what Paul wrote here to Timothy. And that's all he said. But to me, that unfairly dismisses it without due reason. Why do we need to think that the church 100 years later formed this office and not that the office, which was already in existence, had been passed down to them? Believing the first century church had this office is the only solution by which I can make sense of our passage. Because of the clues in our passage and the historical evidence that there was such an office, I can see why there were strict requirements. Now I can understand the problem of women making a vow to join the society and then breaking it to get remarried. I can even understand why the age limit and Paul's explanation for it. It wasn't that he was cruelly excluding younger widows from getting help. They had just as much need. But because 60-year-olds have lived longer, have more stability, and therefore make better counselors and encouragers, they would be better qualified for such an office. They can assure others from their own life experiences that God can meet anyone's dire need. Suddenly, the stringent qualifications make sense. And it explains why such a scandal, bringing such shame on the church when a widow turned away and sought self-indulgence. Now, what does that mean? Let me explain what this term, self-indulgence, means. It is a euphemism for sex. The Bible frequently employs a euphemism to communicate something apart from its unsavory associations. Self-indulgence is a nicer way of saying sex, and how it is used here, prostitution. Again, let's look at it from the perspective of the first century. When a woman lost her husband, she had nothing. She was destitute. She, and especially if she had her children, she had to do something to eat and feed her children. It was desperate. Many women felt that they only had one option if they were to survive, and that was to become a prostitute. Many did. And Paul contrasts this choice with a better option in verses 5 and 6. 1 Timothy 5, verses 5 and 6 says, "She who is truly a widow, left all alone, has set her hope on God and continues in supplications and prayers night and day. But she who is self-indulgent, one who has turned to prostitution, is dead even while she lives." Only widows who didn't turn to prostitution but turned to God in their desperation could be put on the list for this office. Those who resorted to the other decision were like the walking dead. Boy, that's graphic. That's very graphic. They have no life anymore. Very little reason for living. They're already dead. Look again at verse 15. bearing all of this in mind, verse 15 now makes sense. For some have already strayed after Satan. Some have already been put on this list, turned away from it, to go back to this former way of life that Paul is saying have strayed after Satan. What shame it brought onto the church. And that explains why Paul was so harsh. Perhaps it's even more understandable now why Timothy needed to confront those non-caring family members. They didn't care that their relatives had to live as though they were dead, having to resort to prostitution. Confront those despicable family members, Timothy. They are worse than an unbeliever. Confront also anyone who is abusing this system of the office of widows. Keep it from being further scandalized. Make sure that only properly qualified widows can join this group. Now, as we get ready to close our time in this passage, I want to make one other application from it about giving to meet the true needs of others. Whether or not you agree with my decision to believe that there was an office of the church, the office of widows, the application I'm about to give still comes forth. In order to meet the dire needs of these widows, there is no denying that the church had them meet qualifications. And those in need had to render some kind of service to the church. Now, it's this last part that I want to talk just a little bit more about. There is something practical here that I think should be part of our giving in order to help any need. I think it presents itself to us in our passage here. About 3 years before Shelley McKittrick passed away, she told me about a book that had helped her tremendously in her work. As many of you know, she worked at the medical clinic for people who had financial needs. She told me of a premise of the book, and I got copies for all the elders. We went on a retreat where we prayed for our church, and we read this book together. The premise of the book was that merely giving money to a person in need is not the best help we could give them. In fact, it's kind of poor. Their biggest need is to regain a sense of lost dignity. If we don't address their biggest need, in addition to their immediate need for money, we cannot expect them to fully recover. They will always be in need, financial or otherwise. But if we do address their need for a restored sense of personal value and dignity, instead of simply throwing money their way, we can expect greater results. I think that the first century church at Ephesus figured this out. That's why I believe they organized this office of widows that gave them that sense of purpose in life and dignity as they served the church. These widows were given such a purpose and dignity in life and serving others that they even took a vow never to remarry. Apparently, and I'm guessing here, they took that vow so they could serve the church without distraction. Paul advises singlehood in 1 Timothy chapter 7 in order to serve without distraction. Now, God may never have us develop any special office in the church for those we help. That is not my point. But surely, there must be some way that we can work toward assisting those we financially help to also restore their dignity. Perhaps we should develop a list of services they could do in serving the church that we would then compensate them for, instead of merely throwing money their way. So here are two takeaways from today's passage. Both of them, by the way, I hope you notice this, both of them are about keeping dignity in others. Number one, the tone of our truth-telling can build a wall or a bridge. How we tell the truth makes a difference in how that truth is received. Whether we confront someone in the church, we need to have an attitude of wanting to help that person for the glory of God, not with an attitude of superiority that seeks glory for ourselves. Number two, we ought to consider how we can restore or keep the sense of dignity also in those with need that we try to help. Amen. Would you pray with me now?